You are listening to the Full Contact Fighter Radio Network.
Hey guys, this is Dennis Kang. Hey,
this is Mr. Cripples, a.k.a. the Cat Smasher.
Hey, this is John the Natural Alessio.
Hey, this is Rashad Evans.
Hey guys, this is the Big Frog, Jeff Curran.
Hey, this is Mac Danzig.
Hey guys, this is Jason the Athlete McDonald.
Hi, this is Ivan Salvage.
Hey everybody, this is Joe Seltzer, Jay Dirksen.
Hey, it's Mark Machine Hunting here.
Hey everybody, you are listening to the world's most handsome fighter on the planet. Yes, this is El Guapo, and you are listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio with Kelsey Mowat.
Thank you for tuning in to yet another edition of Full Contact Fighter Radio. I'm your host, Kelsey Mowat, coming to you from Vancouver, British Columbia, and another fellow Vancouverite, Jeff Wombat Mazeros, joins us today. How are you doing, Jeff?
I am scrum trelescent.
Nice. You know, and I gotta apologize. I know off-air you were pissed at me because we're doing the radio show during the red carpet TV show of the Oscars, buddy. I know you want to look at the dresses and go
over
who's wearing what.
Yeah, I'm a fashion ophiliac.
Yeah.
Can't get enough of fashion.
Yeah, so I apologize, man, that, you know, we're doing the radio show right now, and hopefully you TVO'd it or whatever it's called, recorded it, and you can watch it later.
Yeah, I'm TVO'ing it right now. Yeah. That's what I'm doing.
We got a pretty
recording
good
with my beta.
We got a pretty good show today. We got Frank Edgar coming on the program. He, of course, recently beat Tyson Griffin, put on a great show. Both guys put on a great show. It was a very discussed fight. So Frank will be coming on the program. And then we've got TNT Tyler Jackson, who just fought last week on Bodog Fight, or at least the fight was aired on Bodog Fight. His fight was a draw against Dmitry Smoilov, so we'll have Tyler on the show. And then at the end, Wombat will discuss Pride last night. Unbelievable. I think there'll be plenty to discuss as far as that card last night.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, stay tuned. You're listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio.
They fight for different things. For some, it's for fame. For others, it's a job. Some fighters just like to hurt people. Visit BodogFight.com and see who the fighters are and why winning matters to them. They'll have a chance to win, but only if that next round matters more than anything. View highlights, read fighter bios, watch TV episodes, or see when the next live event is. Don't miss any mixed martial arts action. BodogFight.com. Make it matter.
The best offer MMA clothing is definitely the Full Contact Fighter Shop, because with FCF gear, you don't have to be a champion to dress like one. Go check it out by now. I know you've seen it, that classic FCF logo on so many great items like our classic t-shirts, tricot jackets. We've got new high-quality rash guards, plus the NXP Extreme Fight Shorts, which are available in red, black, navy, or camo. Of course, don't forget about our fantastic FCF hoodies, a variety of NHB corduroy and distress wash hats, plus now open is the FCF sticker and banner shop. We've got a wide assortment of International Fight League merch, all your favorite teams there. Just head to www.fcfighter.com or call 516-676-0033. That number again is 516-676-0033.
Hey, this is Mac Danzig, and you're listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio.
Joining Full Contact Fighter Radio now is Mr. Frank Edgar. How are you doing today, Frankie?
Good. I'm all right. How you guys doing?
Can't complain. Did you get a chance to catch the fights last night?
I did. Yeah. I did get to, man.
Yeah.
Real good fights.
Yeah, pretty crazy. Anything that stood out for you?
Gomi and Nick Diaz, man. That was a sick fight. Nick Diaz hanging in there, catching him, man. Gogo Fado was nasty.
Yeah, what are your thoughts, before we get into some of the stuff with you, what are your thoughts on that? You know, you heard some of the commentators, I think it was Josh Barnett's, somewhat questioning Gomi's conditioning. Was that your sense after the first round, that he was so gassed, or do you think he was just getting hit with too many shots?
It's a little combination of both. I mean, the way he was dropping his hands, sticking his face out there, man, that was wild. Mm-hmm. You know, just the fact that he was able to still stand up was wild, but I'm sure his conditioning definitely had a part in it.
No, of course, Frank, huge win for you at your UFC debut over Tyson Griffin, UFC 67. Caught a lot of people's attention, man. What are your thoughts on that fight now? Did it go the way you expected? Was that...
I don't like to say exactly what I'm going to do, because it doesn't happen, then you start mentally mind-screwing yourself a little bit. So I just like to dominate position. Any position I'm in, I try to, best my opponent, and that's what I tried to do with Tyson. And, we got in a bunch of scrambles, and I think I was able to scramble into the better positions, which gave me that win.
You know, Tyson is a well-known commodity at lightweight. He's been fighting. He's got some big wins himself. What were your thoughts going in? I mean, do you think a lot of people kind of counted you out, man. What was that like being an underdog going in, and does that make this win that much sweeter for you?
Yeah, you know, I definitely was the underdog, and it's always nice to win when no one expects you to. But when I walked in there, I mean, I didn't think I was the underdog. So to me, it wasn't that big of a surprise, you know, for me. But it's still nice to get the, you know, recognition when people thought you were going to lose.
A lot of people probably would want to know the answer to this. The end of the fight, he had a knee bar locked in on you. It looked like that the knee was getting pretty stretched, hyperextended possibly. Any injury at all? And then how close were you to having to tap?
I was, as soon as I seen that clock, you know, 30, 40 seconds left on it, I was never going to tap at that point. But, you know, I was tight the next day, nothing serious. I didn't really go to the doctor and get it checked out, so I've been, you know, rolling, wrestling, so it's all right.
I know Rogan, during that fight, was making the comment that you must be extremely flexible in the knees. Is that the case, Frankie, or are you just one of those guys that has flexible knees and joints, or do you think...
I found out that night. I guess I am, you know, because I never really knew what I was, so...
Yeah. Yeah, well, it looked pretty nasty, but kudos to you for enduring that. Did you get a chance to talk to Tyson after the fight at all? Did he say anything to you?
Just in the ring, went over there, just said nice fight, but that was it. You know, no more talking after that. Really, I didn't run into him at all, so...
And what's been the general reception as far as back in your hometown? Have you been getting some media? People starting to call you up, ask for interviews first time, or
yeah, it's kind of been crazy, you know, kind of jump in the spotlight a little bit. It's kind of nice.
I always like to ask any fighter this about their UFC debut. First off, how did this process come about? You know, before that fight, you had five fights. You're undefeated. Tell us a little bit about when and how you heard the UFC wanted you to fight Tyson Griffin.
Well, it started out, I think, because I went to trials for the Ultimate Fighter show. And, you know, I guess Dana White or Joe Silva, someone over there, was impressed with me. Because I didn't make the last cut, you know, according to the Spike people. So, you know, I was just sitting home one night, and I get a call from the manager, and he said, they asked me if I wanted to fight Tyson Griffin in 4 weeks or whatever. And I said, yeah, I'm looking down, let's do it.
Nerves going in, are you the kind of guy that gets pretty nervous, jacked up for something like that, or were you pretty calm and collected going in, or what was it like? I mean, you're at the big show finally.
I mean, yeah, to me, stuff starts going through my head as soon as I find out I'm fighting someone, but once I start, you know, calming down after that, training and get into it, I don't really get too nervous. I just get kind of focused on what I'm trying to do.
So tell us a little bit more about that then, as far as the Ultimate Fighter. I'm guessing you mean this most recent show at lightweight. How was it? And you said you made it pretty far, and then you think the Spike people cut you? Is that due to...
Well, yeah, the way the trials go, you have to grapple, you know, in front of them, and then, you know, you make that cut, then you hit pads, then you make that cut, and then then you have to go in front of, I guess, the producers on the show, and, you know, I went, you know, they said, all right, we're going to call you in a week, see if you make it or not. And I never got the call, so I assume it was the Spike people that didn't like with the, you know, something about me.
Tell us a little bit about some of your fights before that. You had a couple wins in reality fighting. It looks like you fought mostly on some East Coast shows. What fight so far outside of the Griffin stands out in your mind, Frankie? What's been your toughest fight to date?
I'm going to have to say the one in November against Jim Miller was definitely a, you know, almost a real, you know, really exciting fight as well. As Tyson's, you know, kind of, you know, I think I dominated the fight, you know, a little back and forth, battle though, in between it all, so it was a nice fight.
I think a lot of people too would want to know a little bit about your wrestling background. It was clear that you that was your, you know, one of your most best qualities in that fight against Tyson. And I know you do some coaching, so tell the listeners a little bit about your wrestling background and where you coach, etc.
Yeah, well, in high school, I was a two-time state place winner, you know, 100-match winner, stuff like that. Then I went to college, four-time NCAA qualifier, Division I. You know, my last year, I was one away from being All-American. So I'm in the mix, you know. And right now, I'm coaching. Coaching my old high school help out there and my buddy's wrestling club, Elite Wrestling, and out of Jackson, so stay busy with that stuff. Helps, you know, definitely helps me with the training here for MMA as well.
So who do you do a lot of your MMA training with then?
Just Rhino. Rhino fight team out of Bricktown.
Okay.
Just want to fight on there.
And you want to tell us about some of the guys that that also train with you, some of the people involved in your training camp?
Yeah. We have you know, pretty good stable of fighters here at Rhino. You know, I think we have like 15 active fighters, and you know, pretty much Chris Liguori, that's the guy I train with most of the time. We got guys like Chris Liguori, you know, Jose Rodriguez, Kevin Roddy, Jason Coleman, Tom Galecchio. All those guys, you know, are right on the cusp of making an impact themselves, you know.
Why this the switch to MMA, Frankie? When did it first captivate your attention, and when did you start training to fight professionally?
Well, I graduated from college May of 2005, and, you know, the show was on, the Spike show was on, you know, you watch that all the time, and, you know, we actually being from, I went to Clarion University, Koscheck was from Edinburgh, so, we all, you know, all the guys from the wrestling team, we used to watch the show together, because, you know, we kind of, you know, we wrestled with that kid, you know, the same division and stuff, and, you know, I kind of just definitely caught my eye on the show. You know, I've seen the Ultimate Fighting in the past, and, you know, I was, thought it was, you know, something I'd like to get into, so when I graduated, I started up a month later, just here in Bricktown, and been running with it ever since.
You made it into the UFC just shortly after, basically a year of competing. What's your thoughts on that, Frankie? Do you look around, and there's a lot of guys, man, that fight for 4 or 5 years before they get that shot, and you got that shot pretty young and early into your career. Any thoughts on that? You think that just based on your wrestling background that you had sort of a head start, if you will, on some other guys that maybe don't have the competitive background that you have?
Yeah, I think that definitely helps, comes into play. I think, you know, a lot of it is kind of luck, too, and timing. So it all kind of worked out for me at the right time, all came together.
Let me ask you about that. You mentioned Josh Koscheck, and some of the we've had some other guests on that have a really well accomplished wrestling background, and we always kind of like to hear their thoughts on some of the better wrestlers out there, just pure wrestling. And Josh Koscheck's going to be fighting Diego Sanchez coming up, and there's a lot of people, you know, now watching Josh fight 2-3 times most recently. It's obvious that he's added to his arsenal. He's not just straight just a wrestler anymore. But a lot of people are saying guys like Koscheck, or for example, Koscheck might be the best pure wrestler in the welterweight division now. Maybe even, you know, better than Matt Hughes, George St. Pierre. He's got great wrestling too, even Diego Sanchez. What are your thoughts on Josh as a wrestler? Do you agree with that notion that he could possibly be the best straight wrestler, at least at 170?
I absolutely agree with that. Like I said, we're in the same division. Our teams wrestle each other. I've seen that kid do amazing things. I mean, his wrestling ability is unreal. His athletic ability, his strength, everything. He's the whole package when it comes to wrestling. And the way he's transferred into MMA is working really well for him. And he'll be tough to fight for anybody fight, you know?
Yeah. You see in the invasion of wrestlers in mixed martial arts over the last 10 years, and back in the day, there was a lot of guys switching over. I mean, Mark Coleman is probably the most notable as far as historically speaking, that crossed over, Randy Couture as well, and they basically just worked with their wrestling. And now you see guys coming in, and they start with wrestling like yourself, but they've already, you know, accented it with other skills, stand-up submissions, obviously. I mean, you need to do that, but how far has the sport evolved, Frankie, and what do you think just a straight wrestler's chances are in mixed martial arts today if someone was just to basically cross over and, you know, just take a fight on 2 weeks' notice, say, no training?
Well, yeah, I mean, it definitely, a wrestler's going to have a great advantage just because of the fact that he's, you know, they know how to compete. They've been in the mix before, you know, so I'm sure they'll come in shape. But, you know, it all depends on who he fights. You know, you can get a straight wrestler coming here and fight a guy that's average, and there's a good chance he's going to win, but, you know, the higher levels, you got to be able to mix it up and do everything, man. That's why it's mixed martial arts, you know. I mean, you can't just be a straight wrestler and expect to dominate in this sport. You got to be well-rounded.
And you're exactly right. I mean, you see that even with a lot of guys, Frankie, people that didn't even really train in wrestling too much. Some guys got into MMA 5-6 years ago. They obviously worked their submissions. They worked their stand-up. But wrestling was not something that necessarily was always included. And now you see clubs, even mixed martial arts gyms, where they have to have a wrestling coach on staff, where they have to offer wrestling classes. So for guys like yourself who may be former wrestlers who don't necessarily fight, is there a lot of opportunities there now to just straight coach and offer some wrestling coaching to potential MMA fighters?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a bunch of our guys here at Ryan will come to, you know, that wrestling club that I coach at just to get wrestling, you know. They go there and they wrestle with the high school kids and some of the other staff members. And, you know, it's definitely helping these guys, you know. If you wrestle, you know, if you're a good wrestler, if you can stop a takedown, you can kind of decide where you want to fight, on the ground or standing up. So, you know. Thanks, man. So, you know, that's definitely a big part of the game is wrestling. If you could stop, you know, like I say, stop a takedown, you can decide where you want to fight. You can, you know, dictate the pace of the fight a lot of times too.
What are some of the general attitudes towards mixed martial arts? You mentioned that you've wrestled in college, NCAA, qualifier, etc. Is it getting more accepted in wrestling circles as far as, and I'm not even necessarily talking about wrestlers, but even the wrestling coaches and some of the older people around the sport of wrestling? It's got such a storied background. Is mixed martial arts starting to become more accepted, Frankie, from what you've experienced in your wrestling circles, or is it still somewhat frowned upon?
From my experience, I think it's getting a lot more accepted. And, you know, it's for guys like me, I mean, doing well in the sport, I think, you know, shows the kids, you know, wrestling's tough. It's a tough sport, you know. There's really no professional after wrestling, you know. You know, you're in baseball, you're going to college, you can eventually help to go pros. And wrestling is really, you know, you go to the Olympics, it's not after that. Now there's, like, an avenue for high-level wrestlers to take afterwards. After competing, if they still feel like competing, so I can make a little money doing it, so that's not bad.
Well, I know Dan Henderson has exactly echoed those sentiments, the fact that they, and Randy Couture as well, that they wanted to keep competing, and mixed martial arts offered them a route for that. Have guys like Dan Henderson, who's been on the Olympic team, Matt Lillen, of course, an Olympic silver medalist, has that helped as well pave the road to acceptance for mixed martial arts as far as wrestlers go, do you think?
At least for me, in my eyes, and in the circle of people I deal with, I think so. You know, I haven't been really anywhere where people in the wrestling community have looked down upon, you know, mixed martial arts. So I think that's definitely helped, you know, those guys paving the way, like you said.
To finish up this interview, I just want to ask you a couple questions about what's next, Frankie. Do you know what's next for you as far as the UFC yet?
I do not. I just understand maybe May or June is when I'm looking to fight again. I guess that's what they mentioned to me, my manager, so. Kind of just waiting on them a little bit and see what they're going to put on the table. So,
you look at a guy like Sean Sherk, who's the lightweight champion and a great wrestler right there. What kind of fighter is it going to have to be to beat Sean Sherk, Frankie? We've had a lot of lightweight fighters on here, and a lot of guys expect him to be the champion at least for a little while, and they all seem to think that he's going to be tough to beat. What kind of fighter is going to be needed to beat Sean Sherk, Frank?
I think a guy that's, you know, really well-rounded, because obviously Sean Sherk can take anybody down. He's powerful, you know, great submission defense. His boxing skills are sound. I mean, you know, it's going to take another great guy to beat him. Not anybody's just going to walk in there and take the title away from him. But the 55-pound division stacked, and there's guys out there that can compete with him, you know. So it's going to be interesting to see who.
Where do you see yourself at in, say, a year? What are your aspirations? Are you looking to fight exclusively in the UFC? Do you want to fight as much as possible, get a few more wins under your belt? What are you hoping to do over the next year, Frank?
Well, I'm under contract with the UFC, so at least for the time being, I'm going to be fighting for them and just try to keep improving my game, you know. I'm not really interested in fighting anybody in particular. Whoever the UFC suggests is who I'll train for, and hopefully just improve and get better.
You know, the division's only been back just, I guess, around a year or so, and it's pretty unbelievable how much talent there is in the 155 division. And I guess avid MMA fans and observers have known this for some time, and we always, you mentioned just how stacked the division is. And lately we've also been asking some of the smaller fighters like yourself, Frankie, if they think there might even be room for a division at 145 sooner or later in the UFC. What are your thoughts on that? And what are your thoughts on the fact that it seems that the lightweight division, after being gone for so long in the UFC, is really being welcomed with open arms by fans?
Yeah, I think the division is definitely being welcomed, and, you know, because they see the potential of the fighters in the weight class, and it's exciting. You know, these guys are, you know, we're a little bit smaller, but, man, you know, kind of like firecrackers, you know. It's exciting from whistle to whistle. And, Yeah, I think if they introduce a 45 weight class, that'd be great, especially for me. I mean, I really only weigh 150, 54 pounds, you know,
okay.
So cutting to 45 would be pretty easy and, you know, probably better for my career.
Yeah. Well, it definitely seems like there's, you know, some opportunities out there for 145ers now that there wasn't before, and I guess Uriah Faber in the WEC, that sort of comes to mind, the UFC, in a way, because they own the WEC, are promoting a 145 division, but it'll be interesting to see if they actually start doing their own.
Yeah, those are the rumors that eventually they're going to maybe move that weight class from WEC into the UFC, but we'll see what happens.
Well, Frankie, congrats on the big win over Tyson Griffin, and thanks for coming on the show, and we look forward to watching you in the UFC over the next year.
All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Take care.
A person who gets punched in the face for a living doesn't know what fear is. Pain doesn't exist if you train more than 30 hours a week. Someone who fights with broken bones has a totally different definition of agony. Bodog Fight mixed martial artists know that fear, pain, and agony won't last. But the glory of having your hand raised at the end of the fight, that lasts forever. Bodog Fight, St. Petersburg. Don't miss any mixed martial arts action. Check your local listings or visit BodogFight.com for details.
The best coverage of the toughest fighters in the toughest sport can only be found in Full Contact Fighter. For over a decade now, FCF has been bringing mixed martial arts fans across the globe in-depth reporting of the world's greatest sport. From Brazil, Japan, Europe, Canada, and the U.S., FCF brings you all the fighter bios, event reports, training and technique tips any avid MMA fan would want. Every month, 12 times a year, we do it. Full Contact Fighter is your best source for MMA coverage. Pick up the latest edition of the paper by subscribing at www.fcfighter.com or call 516-676-0033. Again, the number 516-676-0033. Full Contact Fighter, the undefeated, no-holds-barred news source of the world, and when you call, tell them that FCF Radio sent you.
Hey, this is Bill, the Butcher Mahood. You're listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio.
Joining Full Contact Fighter Radio is Mr. TNT, Tyler Jackson, fresh off a draw of Bodog Fight last week. The airing was last week. Tyler, how are you doing today?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I can't complain. First question for you, When did you get back to Canada from St. Petersburg?
The fight was actually taped on, I believe, December 14th, so, I mean, it was a couple months back.
Wow, so...
It was a little while ago.
Yeah, you've had to keep everything under wraps, and I take it for the last... Was that difficult?
Yeah, it was kind of tough, because you're coming back home, and everybody's asking you, oh, how's Russia, and you really... Oh, you can really say it was all right. You can't act too happy, you can't act too disappointed. So,
yeah.
You don't know really what to say.
No, as I mentioned off the top, it was a draw against Dmitry Smoylov. Tyler, what are your thoughts on the fight? I know you made a couple quick comments on the show that you thought you did enough to win the fight. What were your thoughts? And did his stand-up surprise you a little bit? It seemed like they were kind of casting him as more of a Sambo ground guy.
Well, you know what? I had no idea what to expect when I got in the ring with him. Other than, I mean, I really didn't even know he was a Sambo guy. I just knew he was a Russian, and I believe the Russians told the matchmaker that he was like 5'9", 5'10", you know, walked around at about 176 pounds. So basically going into the fight, you know, we said, look, we'll fight at 170, whereas I'm normally a 155-pound fighter. We said we fight at 170 as long as the guy's not a big 170. I didn't want to go in there but the guy was going to walk in the ring at 190.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, the matchmaker was told that he was about 5'9", 5'10", blocked at about 176, you know, 178 pounds. So we were fine with that. And then, when I finally meet the guy, it turns out he's about 6'1", probably walked about 185, maybe 190. So he wasn't the small Russian we were told he was going to be. And, I was told he was a 1-0. He only had one fight, which is fine. He's 1-0, but I was never told he was a 2005 World Sambo Champion either. So, I mean, it wasn't the Bodog guys at all. They were just telling me what they were told from the Russians, and apparently the Russians aren't completely upfront all the time, which is fine with me. I mean, whatever, I'll fight anybody, I don't care, but
you go in there expecting one thing, and then it's something completely different. You just have to react to it when you get in the ring.
Well, you certainly had the reach advantage on you, and it looked like you're trying to do kind of approach him more from a counter-punching and wait for him to wade in and hit him with some big shots. Surprised at his chin at all? You landed some pretty good shots.
You know what? What I've seen with other Russian guys, I mean, I watched the Bodog fights when it was here in Vancouver, and you know, watching the UFC and stuff, the Russians seem to be just, you know, they're just tough guys. So I mean, they seem to be able to take a lot of punishment from almost anybody, any Russian I've ever seen fight, and you know, he was no different. So
last question before I just let Jeff wade in here is, what happens now? Because Masvidal beat Berger in the other bracket, on the American bracket, and the way they're unless I've got it wrong, that means that either you or Smoilov is supposed to go on and fight Masvidal now. So, but your fight was a draw. So what happens from here?
Well, from here, what's actually happened is we had discussions with Bodog, and you know, they had no idea what they were going to do about it. They're coming up with a couple different options for it, and then it was decided that, you know, I'd go back to my natural weight class at 155, and then fight on the next season. I actually just got back from Costa Rica on Tuesday fighting for season 3 of Bodog Fights.
Oh, okay.
So I just fought out there.
I was going to ask, so what do you do when you're not punching people in the face for a living?
I own my own business called Jackson Strength and Conditioning, based out of the Fraser Valley and primarily the Langley, Surrey area. So I've got a degree in kinesiology, and I'm a certified strength conditioning specialist. So I train a lot of athletes and do some personal training with the general population as well. So
do you think that helps you with, like, your training in terms of, do you think that your education gives you an advantage over people you face in the octagon or people you face in the ring?
I really definitely think it does. I mean, I don't have to be spending all this money going to a strength and conditioning coach when that's what I do for a living, right? So, I mean, I develop all my own conditioning programs, and I also do the same for the rest of the Revolution Fight Team. So, you know, I pride myself in being in top conditions all times, and I believe, you know, the Revolution Team as a whole is a real well-conditioned bunch of fighters. So,
So specifically, what kind of conditioning do you do that you think works best for mixed martial arts?
You know, the main thing is, I mean, if you get right into the science of it, but just really matching what kind of energy systems you're using in a fight. You know, being a fighter, you fight 3 5-minute rounds. So, but not only that, within the 5-minute rounds is a bunch of short bursts continuously, right? So you're using these short bursts, and then you're having to recover real quickly over, you know, a few seconds, and having to use that short burst again. And it's being able to really mash it as much as you can outside of the ring. I mean, the best conditioning is always the sport you're doing. So the best conditioning you can always do is get in the ring and fight. But I mean, the body can't handle doing that every day. You know, you got to keep your fights in the ring. I mean, you can't have a fight every day in the gym too. So it's just matching your run training and your plyometric training, your weight training as much as you can to the energy systems you're using in the ring in an actual fight, and as well matching the movement patterns that you're doing in the ring as well. So, you know, and I mean, whether it's the wrestling aspect, the punching aspect, the kicking aspect, as much as you can, safely matching those movement patterns when you're in the gym. And, you know, training people is not only a science, it's an art too. So, I mean, you really have to take all those things into consideration when you're developing those programs. And, you know, I've done a lot of research over the last, you know, 10 years that I've been doing this to try to really, tailor the program to suit the fighter's needs.
You mentioned Team Revolution, Tyler, and maybe for some of the listeners who aren't familiar, you guys are definitely a well-known commodity up here in Canada. Caleb Stards, of course, on The Ultimate Fighter. Coulter Gill's had some success fighting overseas, or Black Mamba, as he's called, on Bodog. And now some people are getting to see fighters like yourself on Bodog fight. But for some of the people who maybe haven't seen some of that stuff, tell us a little bit about Team Revolution. Who are some of your training partners, and where you guys are located?
you know, we got some great fighters up in Revolution. We got, you know, Todd Gallenberg, who, you know, in my mind is definitely the best 205er in the country right now. And, you know, I could see him going up against the big names in the business real soon and really making a mark in the business. Then we got guys like Blake Fredrickson, who's, you know, he's still a young guy, but he's a seasoned pro. And he's out there with us. And we got Timmy Thurston, who's, you know, got some of the best hands in the game right now. We got Cajun Johnson, who, you know, he hasn't fought in the last couple of years, or hasn't fought a lot in the last couple of years, but, I mean, the kid's improving every day I see him. So, I mean, once he gets back in there, back in the ring, I mean, people are going to see huge differences in his game, and he's, you know, he's going to be an amazing guy at 155 in the country. And, you know, we got just got so many guys. I mean, like you said, Caleb Starnes is around. We got a great team, great coaches, you know, a bunch of great guys to work with. And, I mean, it's a real team atmosphere when you go into the gym. I mean, everybody's, you know, there to help one another and make everybody as good as we can. So, I mean, we got great coaches. I mean, I train with Marcus Soares for my jiu-jitsu, and I mean, 7th-degree black belt under Carlson Gracie. Don't get much better than that. I got my old boxing coach from, you know, when I was doing, I had a bunch of amateur fights a few years back, so he's my boxing coach, and, you know, the boxing coach at Revolution, Roy Witz. And, you know, Colin Baines, who was a Olympian in 2000, I believe, for Greco-Roman wrestling. So, I mean, we got a bunch of great guys. We got the best coaches, the best team, you know. And, you know, for all of us, just going to keep going up. So, but, yeah, Revolution is located on 176 and, or 173rd and 104th in Surrey.
Okay.
So, yeah, great team.
And, before, you know, looking at your career, you started out 2-2, and then as of more recently, at least since 2005, I think you've won 5 of 6. What do you credit that to, Tyler? Is that just a simple matter of more learning more, getting a better skill set, or did you change something up in your training? What do you credit your late success to?
Well, you know what, when I first started, I mean, my first two fights were the three-minute rounds, so it was, you know, it was considered professional, but I mean, it was really amateur rules that I was fighting under. And then my third fight, I was throwing right to the walls with, you know, one of the best stand-up guys in the country, Sam Stout. And, you know, I was fairly new, fairly fresh face in the game when I fought Sam, and, I mean, he won a decision, and, you know, I thought I showed myself pretty well for a guy who's third fight, having his third fight and stuff. And then I fought Samuel Guille, who also, you know, squeezed the other decision with me. And, you know, since then, it was after that fight that I changed teams and started working with Revolution. And really, my first four fights, I was basically a boxer going into an MMA fight. I didn't even know what a side mount was. I had no idea about jiu-jitsu. I had not had a defend a takedown. Like I said, I was a boxer going in an MMA fight. And now I consider myself a mixed martial artist who's got great boxing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, just really working on all my weaknesses in the game and trying to improve those. And that's what I've been doing the past, you know, almost 2 years now. So, you know, just working with guys at Revolution, you know, my teammates and the great coaches we have there, and this just improving my game as a whole.
So what would you say the factors were that involved you going from Gibson Pankration over to Team Revolution?
You know, a major thing is Todd Gallenberg's really the guy who got me involved in mixed martial arts, and, you know, he's a real good friend of mine. And him and Tim Thurston, who I boxed with since I was like 14, 15 years old, Tim went and opened the gym and Todd was managing it. So they kind of started their own team at Revolution, and, I mean, it was the next progression. I mean, they're real close to my house, and it's like 10 minutes away from my house, and started driving out 45 minutes out to Port Moody every day. That was the main thing. I mean, you know, Todd and Tim are good buddies of mine, and they're the ones who got me in the game, and they started their own team, and I thought, you know, that's where I wanted to go. I wanted to be with my friends.
I know you don't. I know you don't want to give anything away about season 3 from Bodog Fight where you competed. But what's next for you Tyler, as we look down 2007? What are you hoping to accomplish this year?
Well, you know what? I think Bodog is the next major organization in mixed martial arts, and just in the entire world, really. I think it's Pride, UFC, and Bodog right now, and those are the three major ones I see. And I'd like to continue fighting for Bodog. I've never seen, they treat everybody so well there, and the right up from Calvin Ayer talking to everybody, this billionaire is just like a real great guy. He's putting all this money in mixed martial arts, and he's talking to all the fighters, and you got the directors of the show, and everybody's great. They treat the fighters really well, and I'd love to stay with them. I'd like to keep fighting for Bodog, and if there's other opportunities that arise, then I'll go wherever the best opportunities are. And right now, I feel that's with Bodog, and I'd like to stay with them.
And now that you're back from, now that your episode with your St. Petersburg fight has been aired, what was the experience overall? I meant to ask you earlier in the interview, but as far as going to another country, being in St. Petersburg, very historic, a famous city like that, what were your thoughts overall on that experience?
It's an experience that I would trade, for sure, because I would never want to rush otherwise. It really opens up your eyes going to a place like Russia to, to really realize how well we do have it back at home. I mean, it's a poor country. It's just like you see on TV when you watch the old spy movies. It's gray, it's dark, it's dirty, and, I wouldn't want to live there. But, it was a great experience going there. They got some great architecture. But, like I said, I would never go there otherwise, and Bodog and mixed martial arts supported me the opportunity to travel the world and see things I would never otherwise seen. And, it was a great opportunity, and I'd probably go back again, but it's probably not for a vacation. I'd go back there for a fight.
Yeah, Jeff and I were talking before we got you on air, and he did the play-by-play for Elite Fighting 1 at the, I believe it's the Ford Art Center in Vancouver. And we were both trying to recall, because I haven't seen a fight again. You got the knockout win over Bobby Merrill. And Jeff, who did you think his opponent was again? How did he look?
Bobby Merrill, he was the guy that was all covered in tattoos, and then you knocked him out, and then after he got knocked out, he dedicated the fight to his dad, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was a great fight.
Yeah, he was a tough kid. That guy was a tough boy, great wrestler, and ever since fighting him, a major thing I've been working on is takedown defense, because he was getting me on my back about 5 or 6 times, so, no, he was a great fighter, great guy, too.
And was that the night, yeah, it was, the same event, wasn't it, where the ropes were really loose, and Travis Ayoub and Marvin Eastman spilled out a couple times? And
Marvin Eastman and Travis Ayoub kept one out of the ring, yeah.
That's your night, yeah.
I remember thinking to myself, and that's a great organization, Elite, and their last couple shows have gone off very polished. But I remember thinking that night, just thinking to myself, this is it. This is going to be the one big scandal. Like, someone's going to fall out of the ring and be, maimed, and then we're all going to hear about it. When you were in the ring, Tyler, you guys are so much smaller than Travis Ayoub and Marvin Eastman, but could you tell that the ropes were pretty loose that night?
Yeah, they seem pretty loose, but I mean, those guys, they weighed in at 205, but I bet you they're probably about 70 pounds heavier than I was in that ring. So, they obviously had a lot more give when they were on the ropes than I would when I was on the ropes. So, but they did seem fairly loose. Luckily, the ring wasn't that high off the ground. It's only like a foot or so off the ground, so it wasn't like a normal boxing ring where it's like 4 feet off the ground. It's fairly close to the ground, so... when they did fall out, I just thank God that, it wasn't a regulation ring that they were falling out of, because somebody would have really got hurt that night.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, do you got anything else for Tyler?
The only other question I have is, I talk to a lot of fighters who have kind of cool nicknames, and there's always an interest story behind their nickname. And, I was just wondering how you got yours, TNT. Did you just sort of pick that out of just give it to yourself, or how did that come around?
No, I never give myself a nickname.
Well, I don't know.
No, it all started when I was at, actually when I first fought Sam Stout, they announced me as TNT, and actually asked Stefan, I believe it was Stefan I talked to, I asked him, you know, how did you guys come up with that? And I just said, well, we've heard a lot about you, and we heard you're a really explosive fighter, and we thought it just kind of fit, and it kind of, you know, went with your name, so we just gave you that, and, you know, it kind of stuck with me, and I just kind of kept it, right?
Yeah, sure, why not? Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, exactly.
That would have been good. Hands of Stone versus TNT.
That's right.
Nicknames.
Yeah, I'd love to fight Sam again, but we'll see what happens in the future.
Yeah, it'd be definitely an interesting rematch. There's no question about that. Tyler, we appreciate you coming on the show, and we look forward to your next fight in Bodog Season 3, I guess, will be the next time we'll see you on Bodog Fight. Best of luck in the future.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks, dude.
You're listening to the Full Contact Fighter Radio Network.
Hey guys, this is Jason the Athlete McDonald, and you're listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio with Kelsey Bowen.
Welcome back to Full Contact Fighter Radio, and as we close out the show, plenty to discuss in regards to Pride 33, second coming last night, and Wombat. First off, overall thoughts on the card before we get into more of the specifics?
Well, I mean, people are calling it a night of upsets, but I mean, it wasn't really... You know, the only upset of the night was that guy, the judoka from Africa who actually trains with Dan Henderson and I'm pretty sure just grew up in the States and maybe has never even been to Africa, knocking out Nogueira. I mean, other than that, I mean, Dan Henderson knocking out Vanderlei Silva, you know, I called that last week, the Nick Diaz versus Takanori Gomi, as soon as they got in the ring, you know, it looked like... You know, Nick Diaz was like, a head and a half taller than Gomi. And what the hell was Gomi doing? He's got his hands down, he's kind of wobbling around like a weeble wobble.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as soon as they got in the ring, I was like, oh, this is going to go very badly for Gomi. Indeed. So, I mean, they're calling it a night of upsets. I don't really know how much of those were legitimately upsets aside from, like, Nogueira getting put on his can, you know? So, I don't know. It was a good card, though. It was entertaining to watch, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, I was thoroughly entertained, and there's my other line going, but I was thoroughly entertained, obviously, and I know what you're saying, and the last week's show, the second show last week, Brendan and I talked about that, and kind of saying that as far as if you looked at some of these fights, there were a couple fights that could go either way, and sure enough, that's what happened, and I agree with you, there weren't necessarily huge upsets, except for Sokaju, and I know what you're saying as well, I believe he did... spent part of his life in Cameroon, but whether or not I'm not sure how long he's been here for, and certainly he's a well-accomplished judoka, apparently. So I agree with you. Other than that, that's MMA, right? I mean, you can take a shot. Anyone can take a shot. Look at Krokop versus Kevin Randleman. You know, no one expected that, and you take a shot like that, and I thought Barnett put it nicely when he said that's the thing about conventional boxing versus MMA is you've got so many different angles and things to consider in MMA that you can get caught with a shot like that.
Right. So with those tiny little gloves, I mean, you put anybody who's like in incredibly good shape, like all pride fighters are more or less, you know, and you put a 4-ounce glove on them and you just get them swinging away at each other, and the first guy that gets hit in the button is going to go down. That's just all there is to it, you know? And I was thinking about this the other day, like when you see Chuck Liddell get in the octagon, every punch he throws is like basically a KO punch. Because when you're wearing little gloves like that, why invest in like pussy little punches that aren't going to, you know, like a jab or whatever? I mean, make it a hard jab. I mean, it's almost like punching for MMA is vastly, vastly different than boxing because of the size of the glove and the angles and all the other various elements at play, you know? And that's the Sokaju guy. They say he's from Africa, but I mean, it's the same reason that they say Carlos Newton is from the Canary Islands, Gary Goodrich is from the Canary Islands, and Carlos Newton is from Trinidad, Tobago, or maybe it's the other way around. Pride likes to have this whole sort of street fighter angle going on where they want like the whole world to be represented.
Yeah.
But the simple fact of the matter is, there's probably very few people in Cameroon who you can put in the Pride ring and expect them to last very long. So they find these sort of transplants, like guys from Cameroon that live in the U.S. or guys from Trinidad, Tobago that live in Canada, and they know how to fight, and then they say they're from this other place. Like they say Dennis Kang, for example, they say he's from Korea, when in fact he's, you know, Canadian, although he's got some French and Korean heritage, you know. So they like to play this whole multinational, international angle thing by finding these fighters and then saying genetically where they're from instead of, like, you know, nationally or culturally where they're from, you know. But I will tell you this, though, there was an upset, Travis Few. I did not expect, and look, James Lee, where did they get that guy from? I didn't even know, he wasn't even my predictions. Where did they find that guy? Was he, like, checking coats at the hotel, and then they just put him in the ring? I, didn't see that. And then he knocks Travis Few on his can, and then ends up guilty and choking him. And I'm like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
That was an upset. That one and the Sejoku guy, those were the upsets. Diaz, I don't know, that wasn't really too much of an upset. And I knew Henderson was going to knock out Silva. I knew it. Because, I mean, Silva, when you look at it, doesn't technically really keep his hands up. He just kind of windmills away like a wild animal, you know? And Henderson's got that straight right hand, and it came through. And he threw a spinning back fist.
Yeah.
What the hell is going on when a wrestler not only learns how to strike, but starts throwing spinning Shoni Carter back fists?
Yeah.
Insane.
That was sweet. And it was a huge left, too, that he landed on Vanderlei to put him down. And, the spinning fist back fist was nice. James Lee,
yeah.
I got to tell you, James Lee... Yeah, definitely not a well-known mainstream mixed martial arts guy. I believe he's one of the top instructors at Team MASH, I think is the name, out of Detroit or somewhere in Michigan. And I saw James Lee fight once on a King of the Cage in Calgary, and he's fighting this kid named Ryan Harvey in his MMA debut. And James Lee is a pretty well-accomplished boxer, and he really gave Ryan a ton of trouble and won fairly quickly. And that's kind of one of the reasons that I love this sport, though, is like, you're absolutely right, a lot of people wouldn't know who James Lee is, but that's part of the reason I love this sport, man, is because people can come in, these guys can be from a certain part of the country, they just haven't had their shot yet, and all of a sudden they get thrown in a huge stage like Pride, and they win. And that's something you don't see in boxing, because in boxing, you're always cultivated, and you don't fight a certain guy unless, you know, you've got so many wins and so on. MMA, it's complete opposite, and anyone
can win. And in boxing, you're wearing a 16-ounce glove, so there's a lot less. It's not as high stakes, if you will. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
well,
also, there's no tackling and submissions in boxing, which is why I think it's boring. But, you know, there you go.
the Trigg-Misaki fight, I think this is going to have huge ramifications on at least the middleweight rankings. A lot of people based on Kazao Misaki's year last year had him top five in a lot of the rankings in the world. And man, I mean, Trigg just ran through this guy. It was almost hard to believe in a sense that Misaki, who gave Dan Henderson, who's a renowned wrestler, he gave Henderson so much difficulty, and Trigg just took him down at will.
Well, I think part of the difference, I mean, the reason that fight came out like that is because Henderson, and as you saw this against Silva, he wasn't just rushing in trying to take Silva down. Henderson is a wrestler who's a lot more content to use his wrestling ability to keep the fight standing and then trade strikes with his opponent. So he, I think, when he fought Misaki, was content to try and trade with him. And Trigg obviously didn't want to trade with Misaki at all. He just kept tackling him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I thought Misaki would have better takedown defense than that. And, you know, honestly, I thought Misaki was gonna pull it off. But I mean, the thing with Trigg is he's the kind of fighter where if he's on top of you, you're in a lot of trouble. And if you're on top of him or you get in his back, he's in a lot of trouble. And I said this last week. Trigg has a lot of holes in his game, but what he's good at, he's really good at. And like he managed to put Misaki down, and he just pounded him out. You know, he's one of those guys. And if he gets on top of you, he's gonna win, you know, and Misaki, you know, did what he could. He tried a couple triangles and stuff, but he got his guard passed, and Trigg took his back, put the body triangle on him, and, you know, and there you go. Is it gonna have ramifications on the ranking? Probably. No, but we'll see who Trigg fights next, and we'll see how well he does against them.
Yeah, and I want two guys that I really was impressed with their performance and showed so much heart. Where the King of the Cage imports or exports to Pride, Jason Ireland, Mac Danzig, both well-accomplished fighters in King of the Cage, stepping up, obviously, in talent against Joaquin Hansen and Hayato Sakurai. But both those guys, Wombat, I mean, showing a ton of heart in their fights.
Oh, absolutely. Both those guys went in there and just put on just a great show. I mean, that's the kind of fighting I like to see. I don't like to see when they put, you know, Kazushi Sakuraba in against some guy named Gilles Arsene from France, who just goes in there and immediately assumes the fetal position. You know, I'm sitting there with my beer in my hand going, well, this is kind of a rip-off, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're going to bring guys into Pride, don't bring them in, you know, out of the back of a bakery. Don't just recruit them out of a pool hall. There's plenty of dudes around that know how to fight, like, you know, like Ireland, like Mac Danzig, and these guys go in there, and did they win? No. Did they put on a good show? Did they give me my entertainment value that I deserve? Absolutely yes. I don't think Ireland even tapped to that arm bar. I think the referee just called a halt to it for moral reasons. He just didn't want to see somebody's arm get snapped, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, live on pay-per-view TV. You know, and Mac Danzig, he was doing really, really well against Sakurai until he got, you know, smashed and dropped. But I mean, he was right in there, you know? And Ireland went in there, and he wasn't afraid of Joaquin Hansen at all. He was going in there and taking it to him, you know? But experience is an important thing, and experience paid off in both those fights.
And when you mentioned the armbar and the tapping, etc., what were your thoughts? You're an experienced jiu-jitsu guy. Haritana versus Michael Russo, there was a little bit of confusion at the end as to what exactly transpired, whether or not he was trying to maintain that he didn't tap. And I think Trick probably had it right, thinking that Haritana held onto that armbar a little bit long, and perhaps that's why Russo seemed like he was complaining after the fact. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I was, you know, I was in my fourth or fifth beer at that point, but I was still watching fairly closely. I mean, the play-by-play clearly showed dude tapping. Like, his hand was, it wasn't even just a finger tap. Like, the tap went from the first knuckle through the second, the third, right into the wrist. There was full hand tapping. Sometimes you see guys where it's just like the very tips of their fingers are moving, and then the referee calls a halt to it. And, you know, obviously that could be considered, you know, whatever. But, I mean, his whole hand was, you know what I mean? It was like he was waving bye-bye to himself, you know, or whatever. So, I mean, there can't be, if that guy is saying that he didn't tap, then he has to seriously go to a doctor and get his arm analyzed, because his hand was moving. And if he didn't intend for his hand to be moving, that could have some serious, you know, ramifications in terms of his whole health, you know. But maybe Caratano did hold on to the arm bar a little bit long. But, I mean, hey, it's an MMA fight, you know what I mean? He's going to go in there and he's going to hold on to it until the ref ries him off, because there's dudes out there who will tap and then say they didn't tap. So you want to make sure that everybody sees the dude tap.
Yeah.
And if that happens to mean his arm, you know, popping once or twice, so be it. It's a fight. I mean, 10 seconds ago, I could have been punching you in the nose and busting your eye socket open. You know, don't complain that your arm got a little bit hurt. You're getting a great big fat paycheck into this, you know? Come on, you're getting paid like $1,000 a second when you really break it down. So,
I doubt Russo was, but...
Well, whatever. If you can walk out of there and you're basically okay, you know, I mean, you should thank his lucky stars that his arm's still attached, you know?
Well, yeah, I don't think Barnett was kind of all over thinking that perhaps that's why, that he was trying to deny that he tapped, but I think Trigg, when he mentioned that, and right away, I think Barnett went along with that too. It was like, well, that's probably what was going on, is maybe he thought it went a little bit too long. But I thought that, to be honest, that fight was probably the most anticlimactic or the least entertaining of the bunch, and pretty much the rest of the eight were amazing. And how about Shogun Hua? I mean, wow, great performance against Alistair Overeem. It seemed like he took a lot away from their first encounter and really did what he needed to do to neutralize Alistair's reach and his stand-up capabilities.
Well, you know, the Alistair Overeem Shogun thing, I mean, the first time those two fought, like I said last week or whatever, Overeem was all over him for the first half, and then he just sort of gassed out, and then Shogun, you know, took it to him. And this time around, he was winning. Like, I don't think there can be any doubt that Alistair Overeem was winning that fight up until the point where he suddenly was knocked unconscious. You know what I mean? Like, he got put in his back, and he was using his jab really well. He knocked Shogun down probably three or four times at least, you know? And then he just kept standing up and letting Shogun up and then knocking him down again. Like, things did not look like they were going to bode terribly well for Shogun, but then, all of a sudden, Alistair Overeem's on his back, and Shogun does that dropping Joe Riggs-style punch, and all of a sudden, you know, Overeem's going back to the land of, you know, marijuana cafes and free prostitution with his teeth all smashed up. You know what I mean?
Well, see, I thought that it looked to me like he was a little bit less eager to stand and exchange compared to their first fight. I thought it looked like he had a bit more of a game plan to try to get Alistair off balance a little bit and take it to the fight. I mean, I think I agree with you. I thought Alistair was winning, but I didn't think he was as far behind as maybe you're making it sound.
Well, there you go. Keep in mind, I had several beer by that point, so you might be very right. But I mean, to me, it looked like Alistair Overeem was swatting him around the ring like a redheaded stepchild. You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden, tides turn, as they tend to do in MMA sometimes. And the thing that amazed me was Alistair Overeem, when he was on his back, he's laying there, he's got his feet up, but he's got his arms back, like behind his head, like he's relaxing on a beach. Like, if you've got Shogun hovering over you with the hammer of doom, like, put your hands up! What are you doing laying there with your hands, like, folded behind your head for? Are you crazy?
Yeah.
You know, and then the fist comes down, and then, you know, you saw what happened. But, I mean, I honestly can't believe that Overeem was laying there with his hands. I mean, look, he had his hands laying on the mat beside his head. What the hell, dude? That's, I don't know. Every now and then you see a fight, and you see somebody do something, and you just don't, like, maybe he was tired, maybe he just wasn't thinking. But, you know, if Shogun's hovering over you, keep your hands in front of your face. I don't care where you are. Keep your hands up, even if you're laying down.
Wombats rant of the week, ladies and gentlemen. There you have it.
Seriously?
Yeah. Nick Diaz versus Takanori Gomi, that fight, we alluded to it a little bit at the beginning of this, but, I mean, all I can say is, wow, that was so entertaining, and you want to talk about ramifications for rankings. I mean, Takanori Gomi now has lost twice in a year. What's your thoughts, Wombat? I mean, are we going to see Gomi Diaz for the title now? What does Pride do with Gomi, a champion who, you know, he looked so great against Ishida, and maybe it just started to sort of wipe the first Aurelio fight under the carpet a little bit, and then now he loses to Diaz. Didn't look like he was in great shape either. But anyways, that aside, what does Pride do now with Gomi?
I don't know. All I can say is thank God for the non-title fight. What the hell is a non-title fight? You have a guy with the title, he fights. How is that? Would they have, is the UFC going to have Chuck Liddell do some non-title fights and get KO'd? Like, what the hell? Yeah. Why even have a non-title fight with your champion? Are you worried he's going to lose? You want to be like, okay, well, we'll fight you. You win, you don't get the belt. What the hell is that? Seriously, it's ridiculous.
Well, you just summed it up right there. They don't. They probably. Gomi is a huge asset for that company, a huge superstar in Japan. And with him being the champion, I mean, I'm not condoning the fact it wasn't a title fight, but I think that's the reason right there is they're probably nervous to have a Nick Diaz as champion.
If you have a guy who has the belt and you like the fact he has the belt, don't put him in against guys like Nick Diaz and call it a non-title fight. Call up Gilles Larsen. I'm sure he's got, you know, some friend who's 155 pounds and is lousy as a dumpster full of crap on a hot day. You know what I mean? Just put him in against shitheads. Just put him in against lousy people. Don't put him in against, like, good guys. Don't put him in against good guys and then say, okay, it's a non-title fight. I mean, talk about a way to, like, disempower your champion by putting him in against the good guys and saying, okay, it's non-title. I mean, if they fight again, Nick Diaz, I'm pretty sure, will kill him. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, did there seem to be in that fight, was there any kind of, oh, okay, well, Gomi could have won if he'd only done this? No!
Well, Diaz, no, I mean, he did drop him once. He did drop him, and if he had tried to capitalize on that a little bit more, maybe things would have been different, but...
I'll tell you this, though. Diaz was a lot bigger, way bigger. Boxing was way, way better. His jiu-jitsu was way, way better. The only thing that Nick Diaz doesn't do that I swear to God he should start doing is when he's on his back and duping his guard, kick the guy away and get up. Why do you lay there looking at me? Ultimately, he did submit him, but Nick Diaz has this weird tendency that I talked about last week to just lay in his back and look for submissions while the guy fires down shots on top of him. And I thought last week that Gomi would be able to do more of that. But it turns out, since Nick Diaz was so physically much more dominant than Gomi, that he completely controlled him even in the guard, you know? I'll tell you this, though. If they have a rematch, and they probably will, between Gomi and Diaz, here's what they're going to do. They're going to have a Japanese ref in there, and as soon as Gomi nails Diaz once, he'll nail him once, and then they'll call an end to it. No, Nick Diaz was clearly unconscious. We have to call a halt for this. And then if Diaz nails Gomi, they'll let it go till Gomi's eyes are rolling out of the ring onto the judges' table. Because they do that. I swear to God. If a Japanese fighter is in trouble, they will let it go. They will not stop it until that guy's brain is, like, crawling out of his ear, like trying to crawl its way to the ambulance itself. I swear, if there's ever a death in MMA, it'll be a Japanese fighter because of a Japanese referee. Did you see the fight between Alex Stiebling and Akira Shoji? Stiebling was on top of him, punching him full in the face for, like, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And Shoji was basically unconscious, like he was starting to decompose.
Well,
the referee admitted. And the same damn thing will happen with Diaz and Gomi. Well, if Diaz gets on top of him.
Yeah, the worst. K1 had a really bad one for that, too. K1 Heroes, the Castillo Smirnova fight against Sakuraba. That was brutal, man. I mean, Sakuraba looked like he's basically unconscious or semi-unconscious, dragging himself, literally, dragging himself out of the ring. And then they stopped the fight and gave Sakuraba a little bit of time to recover, and then he went on to win his credit. But, I agree with some of what you have to say. I mean, obviously, let's knock on wood and hope that no one ever gets seriously hurt. But
But, I mean, the point is, if they have Takanori Gomi fight Nick Diaz again, if Gomi nails Diaz in the melon, in the mush, they will call an end to it right there. However, if Delorena Diaz nails Gomi, they will let it go until the freaking Grim Reaper is coming into the coming into the ring to take Gomi away. And even then, they'll probably let it go. So we'll see. We will see. But it definitely has some huge ramifications, you know? Especially seeing as Nick Diaz, you know, considering the guys he's fought in the octagon and lost to as well. It just throws everything on its head.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I'll be very curious to see what they do next. And you got to, you know, Nick Diaz is the kind of fighter that in a North American market, he can be, he's loved by a lot of people, and some people hate him, but I mean, he's definitely not a straight talker, known to use the profanity, known to speak his mind. And if anything, in Japan, that kind of champion is going to be almost the antichrist to some of the fans there, as far as the way that they usually expect their champs to sort of conduct themselves.
On the way into the ring, Nick Diaz flipped the double bird into the camera. Mm-hmm. He like fingered the entire. What's up with that? Do you not like the audience? Like, what? Why?
I think the camera maybe the camera guy was too close and he just kind of was upset with that.
Oh, yeah.
We should try to get him on the show and ask him.
Yeah, next time he'll like punch the cameraman. Get out of my way, fool! That's very nice.
Well,
but yeah, no, it was good.
And, you know, before we get out of here, Dan Anderson versus Wanderlei Silva, and like you said, we talked a little bit about this from the top, but what do you think, Jeff, now that Henderson's got two belts? He seemed to me like he kind of dodged the question as far as where he's going to compete and what it's going to be like trying to defend two titles. Do you think he's going to maintain both belts and try to defend both belts, or do you think he's going to resign one of them?
I honestly have no idea. You know, like, it's hard to say. It depends how often Pride has him fight. It depends who they have him fighting against. It depends how much they're willing to pay him. Like, there's a lot of factors at work. I mean, Dan Henderson is enormously talented as an athlete. He's technically, his boxing is very good. His wrestling obviously is great. His jiu-jitsu is phenomenal and stuff. So, I mean, would he, in my opinion, be able to defend both those belts? I think if given sufficient time to cut weight, absolutely he could. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if they expect him to defend one belt in November and the next belt in December, I mean, it's going to be pretty, you know, he'll be on like a little weight roller coaster back and forth, yeah. You know what I mean? So who's to say what he's going to do? I think he'll, you know, hey, money talks. He'll probably just do what's best for the old bank account. And, what is that going to be? Who knows? It depends, you know, what kind of contract they offer him, you know? But, I don't know. He's going to be a hard guy to beat. I'll tell you that. In either weight category, he is going to be a tall task. Because the dude's got really good boxing, a really good right hand. He's like a total package, you know?
Yeah.
I don't see him losing anytime soon, you know?
So you've got Gomi, one of that organization Pride's best commodities, one of the most well-known fighters. Somewhat, you know, very much somewhat tarnished. Two fights now, two losses in a year. And Wombat, you know, now the obvious question, Wanderlei Silva knocked out twice in a row. Where does he go from here, do you think? What's Pride going to try to do with Wanderlei? Does he become sort of a gatekeeper? Do they try to get Shogun against Dan Henderson? What do you think they're going to do now?
I think they're definitely going to try and set up Shogun versus Dan Henderson. Silva, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with dude. I mean, the UFC is just going over the top now. And everybody, you know, we were talking about this last week, wants to see Silva versus Liddell. Do they still want to see it? Probably, because, you know, most of the UFC fans, I mean, you know, a lot of them maybe didn't even watch that Pride. Maybe they don't even know that, like, that Liddell... Because, you know, I mean, not all MMA fans like you and me and our, you know, esteemed listeners. We're not all educated dudes, right? A lot of us are just... A lot of guys that watch the UFC are just dudes that were sitting in trailer parks wearing shirts that say Just Bleed. And well, you know what I mean.
Yeah, like, yeah,
they
yeah.
Watch fight TV.
Actually, that's the shirt I'm wearing right now, and I am in my trailer, so I take great offense to that.
Well, there you go. So honestly, I see Silva finishing up whatever contract he's got left in Pride, and then probably going to the UFC, where he's probably a lot more marketable, and he can make a lot more money fighting guys that he can knock the piss out of.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So, you know, I mean, the UFC is really blowing up. They're making a lot of money. There's these rumors that the UFC is going to buy Pride. So I think Silva's going to have one or two more fights in Pride. And then honestly, and this could just be, you know, that the drugs at work, I see him fighting in the UFC in the next year or maybe a year or two, you know?
Well, see, this is kind of what I was alluding to last week. And I read a couple different editorials today about Pride. And it was kind of echoing some of the same sentiments. The fact that now Pride is... It's almost as if, you know, they've got Dan Henderson, and it's a great story, and no one can take away the fact that this guy's got two belts, he's an American, very well-accomplished wrestler, etc. It's a great story. But now you've got Takanori Gomi, not nearly as marketable. I mean, like you said, he just lost to Nick Diaz, a guy who lost a few times in the UFC. And now you've got Wanderlei Silva, where a year ago everyone was talking Chuck Liddell, Wanderlei Silva as the fight to really see who the best number one light heavyweight is in the world. Wanderlei had beaten Quentin Jackson twice, yada, yada, yada. Now he's lost twice. It seems like there's not as much allure behind that fight now either. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do. And I agree with you. I still think that despite all that, Wanderlei, just his appearance, I mean, I don't know if you got a chance to see this, but even just the way that Wanderlei was received at the weigh-ins, I was actually quite shocked. I mean, there was quite a few people there. There was people screaming. I mean, this guy is still a marketable fighter in the United States. I agree with you.
You know what just occurred to me? Chuck Liddell has been talking about how he wants to go up to heavyweight to fight either Krokop or Fedor, in the near future. So after Liddell, if he can knock out Rampage Jackson, right, they might move him to heavyweight and then bring in Wanderlei Silva to be their new 205-pound moneymaker, potentially, in the UFC, you know?
Yeah.
So that could theoretically happen, too. Or maybe they bring in Silva, Liddell knocks him out, they move Liddell up, Silva fights Rampage, whoever that wins, that's the belt holder. You know, there's still a lot of potential. And I mean, like I say, not all MMA fans. In fact, I would say most MMA fans are not nearly as educated as yourself or myself or any of our esteemed listeners, all of whom are geniuses, of course. A lot of them are just people that watch Spike TV and kind of whatever they see, they believe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So to them, if the UFC brings in Silva and they just don't mention that he lost to Dan Henderson, you know, they've got the most wicked striker in the world. Wanderlei Silva, is he a god? You know, all this crap. They're going to believe it. You know what I mean? And then they'll make the money doing that.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, the point is, I mean, I think only about one out of every 10 or maybe one out of every 20 MMA fans is what I would call an educated MMA fan. The rest of them are guys that just kind of hang out at the keg or hang out in the weight room and talk about Royce Gracie and then believe whatever's put on Spike TV. And you know, these are the people who buy the pay-per-views and whatnot, and they'll believe whatever they're told.
Yeah.
So in terms of, like, the rankings and the ramifications and this and that, I mean, it only matters to the people who are smart enough to know about it. And most fans, they just kind of believe whatever they're told. They don't go and, like, really dig into it and get the story behind the story, you know?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of fans, UFC fans, and to a lesser extent, Pride fans. Because if you watch Pride, you're probably in the know enough to know what's really going on. But I mean, I think, you know, in terms of the UFC and in terms of, you know, some other stuff, a lot of people are ignorant and they're going to stay ignorant and because they're just going to believe whatever they're told by the UFC. I mean, you know how it is. I mean, shit, do you think that Tito needed to fight Canna for the third time? No, but that was the biggest selling MMA fight in the history of the frickin' world. And everybody tuned in to watch it, you know? So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, it's gonna topple the rankings a little bit, but I you know, it's not gonna really affect the bottom line. The UFC is still gonna make a lot of money. Pride needs to work on their marketing because right now it's more of the lesser known in the North America kind of thing. And I had a point, but I forget what it was, so I'm gonna stop talking now.
Well, there are some good bits in there, but you know, also you could throw in Tito Ortiz versus Wanderlei Silva too, which
would
remember.
Because Ortiz lost to Liddell, and he's twice now, and he's not going to get another shot at Liddell. So the guys at the UFC, they want some way to turn Tito Ortiz into a moneymaker. Where's the storyline? You know, he just fought Wanderlei Silva. Silva just lost to Henderson, and now the UFC can buy Silva, not mention that he just lost, and just say, "Oh, we bought Pride, most wicked striker, the best Pride fighter in the history of the world," and all these guys sitting at home eating pork rinds will believe them. You know, and then they'll all buy the UFC to watch Tito fight Wanderlei again. And then what will happen there? Probably Tito will probably win again, you know,
yeah,
in theory, because they're in a cage and Tito has better takedowns and all this crap, you know. So,
well,
you know, and then Chuck will move up and blah, 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 blah.
On that note, you know, I've got a 2-liter of Miracle Whip and a big can of imitation crab with my name on it.
Yeah.
And the dogs are going wild in the trailer park out here, so we got to cut it short here. But,
predicted what will happen in MMA until about the year 2035, and by then everyone will have flying cars anyway, so it won't matter. So.
Well, Wamba, maybe we'll try to get you on the show later this week, and we can discuss UFC. We didn't even get a chance to get into that. So, Jeff, enjoy the rest of the weekend and enjoy the Oscars tonight. I know you're salivating to watch that, so.
Yeah, like a Pavlovian dog.
We'll talk to you later, buddy.
All right, thanks.